Disc 6.
Winters told Welsh to put the roadblock between the two buildings, backed up by one of the British tanks. He indicated he wanted Welsh to set up his CP in the manor. Winters checked his other roadblocks, then at 2200 he returned to the northwest corner for one last look around. The British tank was where it was supposed to be, but there was no one in it or around it. Nor were there any E Company men at the roadblock. Highly agitated, Winters ran over to the manor and knocked on the door. A maid answered. She spoke no English, he spoke no Dutch, but somehow she figured out that he wanted to see the soldiers. She escorted him down a hallway and opened the door to a large, lavishly furnished living room. "The sight that greeted my eyes left me speechless," Winters recalled. "Sitting on the floor, in front of a large, blazing fire in a fireplace, was a beautiful Dutch girl, sharing a dinner of ham and eggs with a British lieutenant." She smiled at Winters. The lieutenant turned his head and asked, "Is my tank still outside?" Winters exploded. The lieutenant got moving. Winters went back to the street to look for Welsh and his men. Where the hell can Harry be? He looked at the tavern across the street and his question answered itself. He went in and found Welsh and his men sacked out on the top of the bar. "Harry and I talked this whole situation over," was the polite way Winters put it. "Satisfied that we would have a roadblock set up to my satisfaction and that I could get a good night's sleep and not worry about a breakthrough, I left." In Fechel, the Germans continued to attack through the night and into the next morning. British planes and tanks finally drove them off. The 506th moved out again, getting to Uden on the afternoon of September 24th. The Easy Company men who had been trapped in Fechel assumed that the small force isolated in Uden had been annihilated. Those in Uden likewise assumed that the rest of the company in Fechel had been annihilated. When the two parts reunited and learned that the entire company had survived the encounter in good shape, there was mutual elation. The company prepared to spend the night in Uden. The men who had been there were amazed when the men who had undergone the shelling in Fechel dug foxholes 4 feet deep. They had only dug 6 inches or so into the ground and let it go at that. The officers had billets in houses in Uden. Lieutenant Peacock of 1st Platoon approached Webster's foxhole and told him to come along. Webster climbed out, and they walked to Peacock's billet above a liquor store on the village square. "Take that broom and sweep this room out," Peacock ordered. "Yes, sir," Webster replied, thinking to himself, "what kind of man is this?" He decided, "I would rather starve to death as a bum in civilian life than be a private in the army." The Germans had lost Uden and Fechel, but they hardly had given up. On the evening of September 24th, they attacked Hell's Highway from the west, south of Fechel, and managed to drive a salient across it. Once again, the road was cut. It had to be reopened. Although the strategic objective of Market Garden had been lost by now, on September 20th, the Germans had retaken the bridge at Arnhem from Colonel John Frost's battalion of the British 1st Army Airborne, and the division as a whole had been thrown on the defensive, and the Guards Armored Division had been halted on September 22nd, some 5 kilometers south of Arnhem. It was still critical to keep the road open. Tens of thousands of Allied troops were dependent on it totally for their supplies. The units north of Fechel included the U.S. 101st at Uden and the 82nd at Nijmegen, the British 1st Airborne north of the Lower Rhine outside Arnhem, the Guards Armored and the 43rd Wessex Divisions, the Polish Parachute Regiment, and the British 4th Dorset and 2nd Household Cavalry Regiments, all between Nijmegen and Arnhem. If the 101st could not regain control of the road and keep it open, what was already a major defeat would turn into an unmitigated disaster of catastrophic proportions. General Taylor ordered Colonel Sink to eliminate the German salient south of Vechel. At 0030 hours September 25th, Sink ordered his battalions to prepare to move out. At 0445, the 506th began marching, in a heavy rain, south from Uden toward Fechel. The order of march was 1st Battalion on the right, 3rd Battalion on the left, 2nd Battalion in reserve. At about 0700, the weary men passed through Fechel. At 0830, the 1st and 3rd Battalions began the attack on the salient. Initially, the advance went well, but soon the German artillery and mortar fire thickened. German tanks, brand new Tiger Royals with 88mm guns, dug in along the road, added their own machine gun and shell fire. They were supported by Colonel von der Heydt's 6th Parachute Regiment, Easy's old nemesis at Sainte-Marie-du-Mont and Carentin. The concentration on the narrow front was murderous. About noon, the battalions were forced to halt and dig in. Sink ordered Lieutenant Colonel Strayer to have 2nd Battalion make an end run, a flanking move to the left. It would be supported by British Sherman tanks. There was a wood of young pine trees along the left, east side of the highway to provide a screen for the flanking movement. Company E led the way for the battalion. Company E's first attack in Holland had been to the south, toward Zon and then Eindhoven. The second had been to the east, toward Nuenen. The third had been to the north, into Uden. Now it would be attacking to the west, thus completing the points of the compass. That was the way surrounded troops fight. That was the way the airborne had been trained to fight. Nixon joined Winters to scout the terrain. They found a pathway on the edge of the woods that was solid and firm, providing traction for the tanks. Good enough so far, but the woods ran out 350 meters from the highway, giving way to open ground that provided no cover whatsoever for the final assault. Winters put the company into formation. Scouts out, two columns of men spread out, no bunching up. They got halfway across the field when the Germans opened up with machine gun fire. Everyone hit the ground. Guarnieri and Malarkey got their 60mm mortar into action. Guarnieri called out range and direction. Malarkey worked the mortar. He was the only man in the field at that point who was not flat on his stomach. His first round knocked out a German machine gun post. Winters was shouting orders. He wanted machine guns to go to work. The crews found a slight depression in the ground and set up the gun. They began to lay down a base of fire. Winters spotted a Tiger Royal dug in, hull defileed on the other side of the road, and told the machine gunners to take it under fire. Turning to his right, Winters noticed Nixon, examining his helmet, a big smile on his face. A German machine gun bullet from the first burst had gone through the front of his helmet and exited out the side at such an angle that the bullet simply left a burn mark on his forehead. It did not even break the skin. The German fire was too intense. Winters decided to pull the company back to the woods. The process would be to maintain the base of fire from the machine guns while the riflemen backed off the field. When the riflemen reached the woods, they would begin firing to permit the machine gunners to pull back. When Lipton reached Winters on the edge of the woods, Winters told him, "They, the machine gunners, will need more ammo. Get some out there to them." Lipton ran to a Sherman tank. All the tanks were behind the woods, out of sight from the Germans, much to the disgust of the men of Easy. Shermans used 30-caliber machine guns, the same as Easy Company's machine guns. Lipton got 4 boxes of ammunition from the British. He gave 2 to Sergeant Talbert and took 2 himself. They ran out to the machine guns in the middle of the field, which were firing continuously, dropped the boxes, circled around, and ran back to the edge of the field as fast as they could run. "The Germans were poor shots," Lipton remembered. "We both made it." Just as the German parachute troops began to drop mortars on the machine gun positions, Easy's riflemen went to work, and the machine gunners were able to withdraw. Winters ran back to the tanks. He climbed on the lead tank to talk nose to nose with the commander. He pointed out that there was a Tiger Royal dug in on the far side of the road. "If you pull up behind the bank on the edge of the woods, you will be hull defileed and you can get a shot at him." As Winters climbed down, that tank and the one to its left cranked up and began plowing straight through that stand of small pine trees, knocking them down. As the first tank got to the far edge of the woods, it wheeled left to line up for a shot at the Tiger. Wham! The Tiger laid an 88 into it. The shot hit the cannon barrel and glanced off the hull. Evidently, the German commander had fired blind, lining up on the falling tops of the trees. The British commander threw his tank into reverse, but before he could back out, the Tiger put a second round dead center through the turret. It penetrated the armor. The commander's hands were blown off. He tried to pull himself up through the hatch with his arms, but his own ammunition began to explode. The blast killed him and blew his body up and out. The remainder of his crew died inside. The tank burned through the afternoon and into the night, its ammunition exploding at intervals. The Tiger turned its 88 on the second tank and knocked it out with one shot. Easy spent the remainder of the day and all that night in a miserable, constant rain, raking the roadway with mortar fire. Headquarters company brought up some 81-millimeter mortars to add to the fire. Artillery at Fechel joined in, but cautiously, because elements of the 502nd PIR were attacking the salient from the south. It was a long, miserable, dangerous night for the company, but the battalion S2, Captain Nixon, had a lovely evening. He found a bottle of schnapps somewhere and drank it himself. He knew he had a perfect excuse, his close call that afternoon when the bullet went through his helmet. He got roaring drunk and spent the night singing and laughing until he passed out. In the early hours of September 26th, the Germans withdrew from the salient. At first light, the 506th advanced on the road, unopposed. Once again, the American paratroopers occupied the ground after a fierce firefight with German paratroopers. That afternoon in the rain, the regiment marched back to Uden. Easy Company arrived after dark, dead tired. The following afternoon, the men received their first mail since leaving England 10 days earlier. This strengthened a general feeling that, for the Americans at least, the campaign in Holland was over. That supposition turned out to be wrong, but it was true that the offensive phase of the campaign had ended and failed. For Easy, as for the 101st, the 82nd, and the British armored and infantry outfits involved in Market Garden, it had been a dispiriting experience. For the British 1st Airborne Division, it had been a disaster. It had landed on the north side of the Lower Rhine on September 17th with 10,005 men. It evacuated on September 26th with only 2,163. Nearly 8,000 men were killed, wounded, or captured. Not only had there been no strategic or tactical gain to compensate for such losses, now the Allies had a salient leading nowhere that had to be defended. It was a narrow finger pointing into German lines, surrounded on three sides by a superior German force, dependent on the vulnerable Hell's Highway for supplies. 10 days earlier, the euphoria in the Allied camp had been running very high. One more operation and the war would be over, had been the feeling. The Germans had been on the run ever since the breakout in Normandy, from the beginning of August right on through the middle of September. It had been assumed that their unit cohesion was gone, their armor was gone, their ammunition was gone, their morale was gone. Those assumptions proved to be one of the great intelligence failures of the war. In fact, by mid-September, the Germans were well on their way to pulling off what came to be called the Miracle of the West. They put their units back together, resupplied and refitted them, brought in replacements, established a coherent defensive line. Eisenhower learned from the experience. In March 1945, he wrote his wife, "I never count my Germans until they're in our cages or are buried." Market Garden was a high-risk operation that failed. It was undertaken at the expense of two other possible offensives that had to be postponed because Eisenhower diverted supplies to Market Garden. The first was the Canadian attack on the approaches to Antwerp, Europe's greatest port and essential to the support of any Allied offensive across the Rhine. In the event, Antwerp was not opened and operating until the end of 1944. Which meant that through the fall, the Allied Expeditionary Force, AEF, fought with inadequate supplies. The second postponed offensive was that of Patton's Third Army, south of the Ardennes. Patton believed that if he had gotten the supplies that Monty got for Market Garden, he could have crossed the Rhine that fall and then had an unopposed path open to Berlin. That seems doubtful, but we will never know because it was never tried. To the end of his life, Eisenhower insisted that Market Garden was a risk that had to be run. In my interviews with him between 1964 and 1969, we discussed the operation innumerable times. He always came back to this. The first rule in the pursuit of a defeated enemy is to keep after him, stay in contact, press him, exploit every opportunity. The northern approach to Germany was the shortest, over the terrain most suitable to offensive operations, once the Rhine had been crossed. Eisenhower felt that given how close Market Garden came to succeeding, it would have been criminal for him not to have tried. Until I undertook this study of Easy Company, I agreed with his analysis. Now I wonder. Easy Company was as good as any company in the AEF. It had won spectacular victories in Normandy. Its morale was high, its equipment situation good when it dropped into Holland. It had a nice mix of veterans and recruits, old hands and fresh men. Its officers were skilled and determined, as well as being brave. The NCOs were outstanding. Despite this, in the first 10 days in Holland, just as Winters told Strayer the night of the attack at Nuenen, it took a hell of a licking. It failed to get the bridge at Zaun. It failed to get through at Nuenen on its way to Helmond, and for the first time was forced to retreat. It failed in the drive to Uden. It failed in its initial attack on the German salient south of Vechel. The causes of these failures were many. First and most critical, in every case, the German opposition outmanned and outgunned the company. The airborne troops did not have the artillery or the manpower necessary to launch a successful attack against German armor. Second, these were crack German troops, including their elite parachute regiment. They did not outfight the men of Easy, but they fought as well as the Americans did. Third, the coordination between the British tankers and the American infantry was poor. Neither Easy Company nor the Guards Armored Division had any training in working with each other. This shortcoming hurt Easy at Nuenen, at Uden, and again south of Vechel. At Brécourt Manor and at Carentin in Normandy, Easy had worked effectively with American tanks. In Holland, it worked ineffectively with British tanks. On a larger scale, the trouble with Market Garden was that it was an offensive on much too narrow a front. The pencil-like thrust over the Rhine was vulnerable to attacks on the flanks. The Germans saw and took advantage of that vulnerability with furious counterattacks all along the length of the line and hitting it from all sides. In retrospect, the idea that a force of several divisions consisting of British, American, and Polish troops could be supplied by one highway could only have been accepted by leaders guilty of overconfidence. Easy was one of 150 or so companies that paid the price for that overconfidence. It jumped into Holland on September 17th with 154 officers and men. 10 days later, it was down to 132. Chapter 9, The Island. Holland, October 2nd through November 25th, 1944. Easy Company, like all units in the American Airborne Divisions, had been trained as a light infantry assault outfit, with the emphasis on quick movement, daring maneuvers, and small arms fire. It had been utilized in that way in Normandy and during the first 10 days in Holland. From the beginning of October until almost the end of November 1944, however, it would be involved in static trench warfare, more reminiscent of World War I than World War II. The area in which it fought was a 5-kilometer-wide island that lay between the Lower Rhine on the north and the Waal River on the south. The cities of Arnhem on the Lower Rhine and Nijmegen on the Waal marked the eastern limit of the 101st Lines. The small towns of Opheusden on the Lower Rhine and Dodewaard on the Waal were the western limit. The Germans held the territory north of the Lower Rhine and west of the Opheusden-Dodewaard line. The island was a flat agricultural area, below sea level. Dikes that were 7 meters high and wide enough at the top for two-lane roads held back the floodwaters. The sides of the dikes were sometimes steep, more often sloping so gradually as to make the dikes 200 or even 300 feet wide at the base. Crisscrossing the area were innumerable drainage ditches. Hills rose on the north side of the Lower Rhine, giving the Germans a distinct advantage in artillery spotting. They had apparently unlimited ammunition. The German industrial heartland was only 50 kilometers or so up the Rhine River, enough at any rate to enable them to fire 88s at single individuals caught out in the open. All movement on the island was by night. During daylight hours, men stayed in their foxholes, observation posts, or houses and barns. The fall weather in northwest Europe was, as usual, miserable, cold, humid, rainy, a fit setting for a World War I movie. There were whole regiments of British artillery on the island, firing in support of the 101st. This meant that island battles were artillery duels, in which the main role of the infantry was to be prepared to hurl back any assault by the German ground troops and to serve as forward artillery observers. Patrols went out every night to scout and to maintain contact with the enemy. For the most part, however, Easy and the other companies in the 101st sat there and took it, just as their fathers had done in 1918. A man's inability to do anything about the artillery fire added to the widespread, overwhelming feeling of frustration. But of course, it was not 1918. On the island, the men of Easy first saw jet airplanes in action. They watched vapors from the V-2s, the world's first medium-range ballistic missile, as they passed overhead on the way to London. Still, as had been true of soldiers on the Western Front in 1914 through 1917, they fought without tank support, as a tank was much too conspicuous a target on the island. The rations added to the sense that Easy was in a World War I movie rather than a real 1944 battle. The company drew its rations from the British, and they were awful. The British 14-in-1s, according to Corporal Gordon, will support life, but not morale. Bully beef and heavy Yorkshire pudding were particularly hated, as was the oxtail soup, characterized as grease with bones floating in it. Most men took to throwing everything in the 14-in-1s into a single large pot, adding whatever vegetables they could scrounge from the countryside and making a sort of stew out of it. Fortunately, there was fresh fruit in abundance, mainly apples and pears. Cows that desperately needed milking were relieved of the contents of their bulging udders, and that helped. But there was no coffee, and the men quickly tired of tea. Worst of all were the English cigarettes. Corporal Rod Bain described them as a small portion of tobacco and an ungodly amount of straw. Best of all was the daily British rum ration. Next best was finding German rations. The hard biscuits were like concrete, but the canned meat and tubes of Limburger cheese were tasty and nutritious. As had been true of the villages of France on both sides of the line on the Western Front, 1914 through 1918, the civilian residents of the island were evacuated, and Holland is the most densely populated country on earth. This gave the men almost unlimited opportunities for looting, opportunities that were quickly seized. Webster wrote, "Civilians dwell under the misimpression that only Germans and Russians go through drawers, closets, and chicken coops, whereas every GI of my acquaintance made a habit of doing so. Watches, clocks, jewelry, small and large pieces of furniture, and of course liquor quickly disappeared. That is, what was left, as the British had already stripped the area." The island was most like World War I in its stagnated front. Easy spent nearly 2 months there in daily combat. It sent out almost 100 patrols, It repelled attacks. It fired an incredible amount of ammunition. It took casualties, but when it was finally relieved, it turned over to the relieving party frontline positions that had hardly moved one inch. The company moved onto the island on October 2nd by truck over the magnificent bridge at Nijmegen, still standing, that had been captured by the 82nd on September 20th at 8 p.m. Once over the Waal, the trucks took the men some 15 kilometers past dozens of camouflaged British artillery pieces to the village of Zetten. They arrived at night to relieve the British 43rd Division. The 506th Regiment was taking over a stretch of front line that had been held by a full division. It was over 6 miles in length. The 2nd Battalion of the 506th was on the right east end of the line, with Easy on the far right, with the 501st PIR to its right. Easy had to cover almost 3 kilometers with only 130 men. The British soldiers met the company at Zetten and escorted the leading elements to their new positions. "What's it like up here?" Webster asked. "It's a bloody rest position, mate," was the reply. The numerous craters from the 105s and 88s looked fresh to Webster, who doubted that he was being given straight scoop. After a 3-hour march, the patrol reached its destination, a clump of houses nestled beside a huge dike. The lower Rhine was on the other side of the dike, with a kilometer or so of flat, soggy grazing land between it and the dike. The area was littered with dead animals, burned houses, and empty machine gun belts and ammo boxes. This was no man's land. To cover his assigned section of the front, Winters put the 2nd and 3rd platoons on the line, along the south side of the dike, with the 1st platoon in reserve. He did not have sufficient troops to man the line properly, so he placed outposts along the dike at spots that he calculated were most likely enemy infiltration points. He kept in contact with the outposts by means of radio, wire, and contact patrols. He also sent 3-man patrols to the riverbank to watch for enemy movement and to serve as forward artillery observers. He set up his CP at Rontvik. At 0330 October 5th, Winters sent Sergeant Art Eumann out on a patrol with orders to occupy an outpost in a building near a windmill on the south bank of the dike. With Eumann were Privates James Alley, Joe Lesniewski, Joe Liebgott, and Rod Stroll. The building was beside a north-south road that ran to a ferry crossing on the river to the north, back to the small village of Nyborg to the south. When the patrol reached the road, Eumann told Lesniewski to go to the top of the dike to look things over. When he reached the top, hugging the ground as he had been taught, Lesniewski saw an unexpected sight: the outline of a German machine gun set up at a point where the road coming from the ferry crossed the dike. Behind it, in the dark, he could just make out a German preparing to throw a potato masher grenade at Eumann's patrol down at the south base of the dike. Simultaneously, the other members of the patrol heard German voices on the north side of the dike. Liebgott, who was trailing, called out, "Is that you, Eumann?" The German threw the grenade as Lesniewski called out a warning. Other Germans pitched grenades of their own over the dike. Lesniewski got hit in the neck by shrapnel. Alley got blown to the ground by a blast of shrapnel that left 32 wounds in his left side, face, neck, and arm. Stroll and Liebgott took some minor wounds. Stroll's radio was blown away. They had run into a full company of SS troops. It had come across the river by ferry earlier that night and was attempting to infiltrate south of the dike to make a diversionary assault in support of a major attack the 363rd Volksgrenadier Division was scheduled to launch at first light against the left flank of the 506th at Ophüsden. Although the patrol did not know it, another SS company had crossed the dike and was on the loose behind American lines. Although division did not yet know it, the attack on 1st and 2nd Battalions of the 506th was much more than just a local counterattack. The German objective was to clear the entire island area of Allied troops. After the skirmish with the 1st SS Company, the E Company patrol fell back. It was a full kilometer to Winter's CP. "Come on, Allie," Stroll kept saying. We've got to get our asses out of here. I'm coming, I'm coming, the limping Allie replied. At 0420, Stroll got back to the CP to report the German penetration. When I did a joint interview with Stroll and Winters in the summer of 1990, the conversation went as follows. Ambrose, so Rod comes back and tells you, we've got a penetration here. Now pick up the story. Winters, let me tell you, when he comes in, he's been in combat. He is breathless, and you take one look at him, and you know here's a guy that has just faced death, no question about it. Stroll, I didn't look that bad. Winters, you don't have to be ashamed of it. Somebody's shooting at you. Stroll, he's saying I shit my pants. I never. Winters immediately organized a patrol consisting of a squad and a half from 1st Platoon, which was in reserve, plus Sergeant Leo Boyle from HQ section with a radio. Sergeant Talbert ran back to the barn where his men were sleeping. Get up, everybody out, he shouted. The krauts have broken through. God damn you people, get out of those beds. Webster and the others shook themselves awake, grabbed their rifles and moved out. Winters and his 15-man patrol moved forward quickly along the south side of the dike. As they approached the SS company, he could see tracer bullets flying off toward the south. The firing made no sense to him. He knew there was nothing down that way and guessed that the Germans must be nervous and confused. He decided to stop the patrol and make his own reconnaissance. Leaving the patrol under Sergeant Boyle's command, he crawled to the top of the dike. On the other north side, he saw that there was a 1-meter-deep ditch running parallel to the dike. It would provide some cover for an approach to the road. He returned to the patrol, ordering two men to stay where they were, as rear and right flank protection, and took the remainder up and over the dike to the ditch on the north side. The group then moved forward cautiously down the ditch toward the road. When he was 200 meters from the road, Winters stopped the patrol again and moved forward alone to scout the situation. As he neared the road, which was raised a meter or so above the field, he could hear voices on the other side. Looking to his right, he could see German soldiers standing on top of the dike by the machine gun position, silhouetted against the night sky. They were wearing long winter overcoats and the distinctive German steel helmets. Winters was about 25 meters from them, down in the drainage ditch. He thought to himself, this is just like the movie All Quiet on the Western Front. He crawled back to the patrol, explained the situation, and gave his orders. We must crawl up there with absolutely no noise, keep low, and hurry. We won't have the cover of night with us much longer. The patrol got to within 40 meters of the machine gun up on the dike. Winters went to each man and, in a whisper, assigned a target, either the rifleman or the machine gun crew. Winters whispered to Christensen to set up his 30-caliber machine gun and concentrate on the German MG-42. Behind Christensen, Sergeant Muck and PFC Alex Pencala set up their 60-millimeter mortar. Stepping back, Winters gave the order, ready, aim, fire, in a low, calm, firing-range voice. 12 rifles barked simultaneously. All 7 German riflemen fell. Christensen's machine gun opened up. He was using tracers, and he could see he was shooting too high. But as he depressed his fire, Muck and Pencala dropped a mortar round smack on the German machine gun. Sergeant Boyle was astounded at the heavy, accurate fire that we delivered at the enemy. He later told Lipton he thought it was the best shooting he had ever seen. The patrol began to receive some light rifle fire from across the road running from the dike to the ferry. Winters pulled it back from the ditch for about 200 meters to a place where the ditch connected with another that ran perpendicular to it from the dike to the river. Out of range of the Germans, he got on Boyle's radio and called back to Lieutenant Welsh. Set up the balance of the 1st Platoon, he ordered, and the section of light machine guns from HQ Company attached to E Company. As the patrol waited for the reinforcements, Sergeant William Dukeman stood up to shout at the men to spread out. As Gordon Carson, who recalled the incident, remarked, the men will congregate in a minute. 3 Germans, hiding in a culvert that ran under the road, fired a rifle grenade. Dukeman gave a sigh and slumped forward. He was the only man hit. A chunk of steel went in his shoulder blade and came out through his heart, killing him. The survivors opened up with their rifles on the Germans in the culvert and killed them in return. While waiting for the remainder of the platoon to come forward, Winters went out into the field between the two lines to be alone and to think things through. Three facts struck him. The enemy was behind a good solid roadway embankment, while his men were in a shallow ditch with no safe route for withdrawal. The enemy was in a good position to outflank the patrol to the right and catch it in the open field. There was nothing south of the bank to stop the Germans from moving down the road unmolested to the 2nd Battalion CP at Hemmen. Under the circumstances, he decided he had no choice but to attack. It was now full daylight. Returning to the patrol, he found that the reinforcements had arrived. Now he had some 30 men. He called Lieutenants Frank Reese and Thomas Peacock and Sergeant Floyd Talbert together and gave his orders. Talbert, take the 3rd squad to the right. Peacock, take the 1st squad to the left. I'll take the 2nd squad right up the middle. Reese, put your machine guns between our columns. I want a good covering fire until we reach that roadway. Then lift your fire and move up and join us. He told Talbert and Peacock to have their men fix bayonets. As his subordinates went off to carry out his orders, Winters called the 2nd squad together and explained the plan. Private Hubler was standing right in front of him. When Winters said, "Fix bayonets," Hubler took a big swallow. Winters could see his Adam's apple move up and down his throat. His adrenaline was flowing. "My adrenaline was pumping too," Winters remembered. On his signal, the machine guns began laying a base of fire, and all three columns started to move as fast as they could across the 200 meters of level but spongy soft field between them and the road, doing their best to keep low. At this point, Winters had no firm idea on how many Germans were on the other side of the road running from the dike to the ferry, which was just high enough to block his view. Nor did the Germans know the Americans were coming. Inexcusably, after losing their machine gunners and riflemen on the first volley, they had failed to put an outpost on the road or up on the dike. In the lead, Winters got to the road first. He leaped up on it. Right in front of him, only a few feet away, was a German sentry with his head down, ducking the incoming fire from Reese's machine guns. To his right, Winters could see out of the corner of his eye a solid mass of men, more than 100 packed together, lying down at the juncture of the dike and the road. They, too, had their heads down to duck under the machine gun fire. They were all wearing their long winter overcoats and had their backpacks on. Every single one of them was facing the dike. He was behind them. They were only 15 meters away. Winters wheeled and dropped back to the west side of the road, pulled the pin of a hand grenade, and lobbed it over toward the lone sentry. Simultaneously, the sentry lobbed a potato masher back at him. The instant Winters threw his grenade, he realized he had made a big mistake. He had forgotten to take off the band of tape around the handle of the grenade he kept there to avoid an accident. Before the potato masher could go off, Winters jumped back up on the road. The sentry was hunched down, covering his head with his arms, waiting for Winters' grenade to go off. He was only 3 yards away. Winters shot him with his M1 from the hip. The shot startled the entire company. The SS troops started to rise and turn toward Winters en masse. Winters pivoted to his right and fired into the solid mass. Winters described what happened next. "The movements of the Germans seemed to be unreal to me. When they rose up, it seemed to be so slow. When they turned to look over their shoulders at me, it was in slow motion. When they started to raise their rifles to fire at me, it was in slow, slow motion. I emptied the first clip, 8 rounds, and still standing in the middle of the road, put in a 2nd clip, and still shooting from the hip, emptied that clip into the mass. Germans fell. Others began aiming their rifles at Winters. Others started running away from him, but all their movements were awkward, hampered by those long overcoats. He dropped back to the west side of the road. Looking to his right, he could see Talbert running, crouched over, leading his column. It was still 10 meters from the road. Winter's own column, in the middle, was struggling through the field. Peacock's column on the left was 20 meters short of the road, held up by some wires running across the field. Winters put in a third clip and started popping up, taking a shot or two, then dropping back down. The Germans were running away as best they could when the other American columns reached the road. "Fire at will," Winters called out. It was a duck shoot. The Germans were fleeing. The Easy Company riflemen were shooting them unmolested. "I got one," Webster heard Hubler call out. "Damn, I got one." According to Webster, Hubler was in his element. He ate this stuff up. A bunch of Germans were cut off, hiding in some tall weeds. Christensen spotted them. "Anybody here speak German?" he called out. Webster came up. "Heraus!" he yelled. "Schnell! Hente hoch! Schnell! Schnell!" One by one, 11 Germans came out. Husky, hard-boiled, they claimed they were Poles. Christensen motioned them to the rear. Webster went back to the road to get in on the shooting. A German turned to fire back. "What felt like a baseball bat slugged my right leg," Webster recalled. "Spun me around and knocked me down." All he could think to say was, "They got me," which even then seemed to him an inadequate and unimaginative cliché. Like all writers, he was composing his description of the event as it happened. It was a clean wound. The bullet went in and out of Webster's calf, hitting no bone. $1 million wound. "I got it made," he thought to himself. When medic Eugene Rowe got to him, Webster had a big grin on his face. Rowe patched the wound and told Webster to retire. Webster gave his bandoliers to Martin, who was still very calm and unconcerned, the calmest, most fearless person I ever saw, and his grenades to Christensen. He kept his pistol and M1 and began limping to the rear. Winters could see more German soldiers about 100 yards away, pouring over the dike from the south side, the previously unnoticed SS company. They joined their retreating comrades in a dash to the east, away from the Easy Company fire. This made the target bigger. Lieutenant Rees had brought the machine guns forward by this time. Private Cobb set his up and began putting long-distance fire on the routed German troops. The surviving German troops reached a grove of trees where there was another road leading to the river. As Winters observed, they swung left and began to follow that road to the river. Winters got on the radio and called for artillery. British guns began pounding away at the main force of retreating Germans. Winters wanted to push down to the river on his road to cut off the Germans at the river, but 35 men against the 150 or so surviving Germans was not good odds. He got on the radio again to ask 2nd Battalion HQ for support. HQ promised to send a platoon from Fox Company. Waiting for the reinforcements, Winters made a head count and reorganized. He had one man dead, Dukeman, and 4 wounded. 11 Germans had surrendered. Liebgott, slightly wounded in the arm, was a walking casualty. Winters ordered him to take the prisoners back to the battalion CP and then get himself tended by Dr. Nevels. Then he remembered that Liebgott, a good combat soldier, had a reputation of being very rough on prisoners. He also heard Liebgott respond to his order with the words, "Oh, boy, I'll take care of them." "There are 11 prisoners," Winters said, "and I want 11 prisoners turned over to battalion." Liebgott began to throw a tantrum. Winters dropped his M1 to his hip, threw off the safety, pointed it at Liebgott, and said, "Liebgott, drop all your ammunition and empty your rifle." Liebgott swore and grumbled, but did as he was ordered. "Now," said Winters, "you can put 1 round in your rifle. If you drop a prisoner, the rest will jump you." Winters noticed a German officer who had been pacing back and forth, obviously nervous and concerned over Liebgott's exuberance when he first got the assignment. Evidently, the officer understood English. When he heard Winters' further orders, he relaxed. Liebgott brought all 11 prisoners back to Battalion HQ. Winters knew that for certain, as he checked later that day with Nixon. The ferry crossing the Germans had used to get over and now would need to get back was at the end of the road Easy Company was on. Winters wanted to get there before they did. When the platoon from Fox Company arrived, bringing more ammunition, Winters redistributed the ammo and then gave his orders. He set up a base of fire with half the 60 or so men under his command, then had the other half move forward 100 meters, stop and set up its own base of fire, and leapfrog the first group down the road. He intended to repeat this maneuver the full 600 or so meters to the river. About 200 meters short of the river, Winter's unit reached some factory buildings. German artillery had started to work. The SS troops, desperate to get to the ferry, mounted a 75-man attack on the right rear flank of the Americans. Winters realized he had overreached. It was time to withdraw to be able to fight another day. The unit leapfrogged in reverse back to the dike. Just as the last men got over the dike, the Germans cut loose with a terrific concentration of artillery fire on the point where the road crossed the dike. They had it zeroed in perfectly. The airborne men scattered right and left, but not before suffering many casualties. Winters grabbed the radio and called Battalion HQ to ask for medics and ambulances. Doc Nevels came on and wanted to know how many casualties. "Two baseball teams," Winters replied. Nevels knew nothing about sports. He asked Winters to put it in clear language. "Get the hell off the radio so I can get some more artillery support," Winters shouted back, "or we'll need enough for three baseball teams." Just at that moment, Boyle heard some mortars coming. You could tell they were going to be close. Boyle wasn't moving too fast as he was exhausted, a result of a less than complete recovery from his wound received in Normandy. I pitched forward on the dike. A shell hit just behind me on the left and tore into my left leg from the hip to the knee, and that was it. A terrible blow, but no pain. Just before he lost consciousness, Winters tapped him on the shoulder and told him he would be taken care of. Guarnieri and Christensen cut his pants leg off and sprinkled sulfur powder on the horrible wound. Most of the flesh on Boyle's left thigh had been torn away. They gave him morphine and got stretcher-bearers to carry him rearward. Webster, alone, was trying to cross an open field to get to an aid station. He was crawling along a cow path lower than he had ever gotten in training, crawling through mud and cow dung. He ripped his pants on barbed wire fence. On the far side, he risked getting up and limping the last 100 yards to safety. A German observer saw him and called down some 88s. Three explosions, one on each side, one behind, made Webster feel terrified and self-conscious. He managed to get out of the field before the 88 completed the bracket. Some F Company men helped him to a road junction. Two medics with a jeep coming back from the dike picked him up, laid him across the engine hood, and told me to relax. They said we would be going fast because the man on the rear stretcher, Sergeant Boyle, was badly wounded and in need of immediate medical attention. Altogether, the two platoons from Easy and Fox Company took 18 casualties from that artillery bombardment, none killed. Winters set up strong points to cover the place where the road crossed the dike. Captain Nixon came up. "How's everything going?" he asked. For the first time since the action began, Winters sat down. "Give me a drink of water," he said. As he reached for Nixon's canteen, he noticed that his hand was shaking. He was exhausted. So was Christensen. He couldn't understand it until he counted up. He realized that he had fired a total of 57 clips of M1 ammunition, 456 rounds. That night, while trying to stay awake on outpost duty and trying to calm down after being so keyed up, Christensen pissed 36 times. With 35 men, a platoon of Easy Company had routed two German companies of about 300 men. American casualties, including those from Fox Company, were 1 dead, 22 wounded. German casualties were 50 killed, 11 captured, about 100 wounded. Later, Winters realized that he and his men had been very, very lucky. In an analysis, he said the main reason for success was the poor quality of German leadership. The Germans had let the first squad get away with sitting in the field waiting for reinforcements. They had bunched up in one big mass, inexcusable in Winter's view. They had allowed two machine guns to pin them down while the three columns of Easy ran 200 yards across the field in a bayonet charge. They had reacted much too slowly when Winters fired on them from the road. They failed to put together an organized base of fire when the shooting started. Easy, by contrast, did almost everything right. Winters called this the highlight of all E Company actions for the entire war, even better than D-Day, because it demonstrated Easy's overall superiority in every phase of infantry tactics: patrol, defense, attack under a base of fire, withdrawal, and above all, superior marksmanship with rifles, machine gun, and mortar fire. More can be said. For example, the physical fitness of the Easy men was a sine qua non. They put out more energy than a heavyweight boxer in a 15-round title match. Way more. They put out more energy than a man would playing 60 minutes in three consecutive football games. Also notable was the company's communication system, with radio messages, runners, and hand signals being used effectively. The leapfrog advances and retreats put into play the training they had undergone at Tekoa and were carried out in textbook fashion. The evacuation of the wounded was likewise carried out with calm efficiency. The coordination with British artillery was outstanding. So was Winters. He made one right decision after another, sometimes instinctively, sometimes after careful deliberation. The best was his decision that to attack was his only option. He provided not only brains, but personal leadership. "Follow me" was his code. He personally killed more Germans and took more risks than anyone else. But good as Easy Company of the 506th was, and there was no better light infantry company in the army, there was nothing it could do about that terror of the battlefield, modern artillery. Easy had to cross the dike to get home. It could not stay in the open field and get pounded. But in crossing the dike, the company exposed itself to zeroed-in German artillery. A few minutes of total terror, and the company had taken more casualties than it had in its encounter with German riflemen by the hundreds earlier in the day. "Artillery is a terrible thing," Webster said. "God, I hate it." The Public Relations Office of the 101st Airborne Division gave the action extensive publicity in typical wartime jargon. "Winter's order had to be and was for a bayonet attack. As a result of that brave order, two companies of SS were heavily battered and forced to withdraw without getting an opportunity to start their attack, which was scheduled to start at almost that very instant." Insofar as the German 363rd Volksgrenadier Division launched a major attack at Ophüsden at dawn that day against the left flank of the 506th, the small action at the dike may have been crucial. Had the German SS companies proceeded unmolested south of the dike, they would have hit regimental HQ at exactly the moment Colonel Sink had to concentrate his attention on Ophüsden. Sink was appreciative. He issued a general order citing 1st Platoon of Easy for gallantry in action. After describing the bayonet charge, he wrote, "By this daring act and skillful maneuver against a numerically superior force, the platoon inflicted heavy casualties on the enemy and turned back the enemy's attempt to attack Battalion HQ from the rear." A couple of days after the bayonet attack, Colonel Sink paid Winters a visit. "Do you think you could handle the battalion?" he asked, indicating that he was considering making Winters the XO of 2nd Battalion. Major Oliver Horton had been killed in the Battle of Ophüsden on October 5th. Winters, 26 and a half years old, a captain and company commander for only 3 months, gulped and replied, "Yes, sir. I know I can handle our battalion in the field. Combat doesn't worry me. It's the administration. I've never had administration." "Don't worry," Sink assured him. "I'll take care of that part." On October 9th, he made Winters the XO of 2nd Battalion. Winters' replacement as Easy Company commander failed to measure up. He came in from another battalion. Private Ralph Stafford was scathing in his description. "He really screwed up. He not only didn't know what to do, he didn't care to learn. He stayed in bed, made no inspections, and sent for more plums." He was shortly relieved. Other replacement officers had also failed. Christensen said of one, "Indecision was his middle name. In combat, his mind became completely disoriented, and he froze. We, the NCOs of the platoon, took over and got the job done, and never did he complain, for he realized his inability to command under pressure." Webster wrote about a platoon leader in the Nunen fight. "I never saw him in the fracas. He never came to the front. He failed to live up to his responsibilities. The old men in the platoon never forgave him. For an enlisted man to fail in a grave situation was bad, but for an officer who was supposed to lead his men, it was inexcusable." Malarkey related that in that fight, Guarnieri was giving hell to some officer who had his head buried in the sand, telling him he was supposed to be leading the platoon. The same officer was later seen at an aid station, shot through the hand, suspected of being self-inflicted. A combination of new officers and men who had not been trained up to the standard of the original Currie group, the rigors of constant pounding by artillery, and the danger of night patrols was taking a toll on Easy. The conditions exacerbated the situation. Paul Fussell has described the two stages of rationalization a combat soldier goes through. "It can't happen to me." Then, "It can happen to me unless I'm more careful." Followed by a stage of accurate perception. "It is going to happen to me, and only my not being there, on the front lines, is going to prevent it." Some men never get to the perception. For others, it comes almost at once. When it does come to a member of a rifle company in the front line, it is almost impossible to make him stay there and do his duty. His motivation has to be internal. Comradeship is by far the strongest motivator. Not wanting to let his buddies down in the positive sense, not wanting to appear a coward in front of the men he loves and respects above all others in the negative sense. Discipline won't do it, because discipline relies on punishment, and there is no punishment the Army can inflict on a frontline soldier worse than putting him on the front line. Except certain death. The Wehrmacht in Normandy, for example, had German sergeants standing behind foreign conscripts. A Pole in the Wehrmacht at Omaha Beach managed to be taken prisoner. At his interrogation, he was asked how the frontline troops stood up to the air and naval pounding. "Your bombs were very persuasive," he replied, "but the sergeant behind me with a pistol in his hand was more so." But the American Army didn't do things that way. One reason for this is what Glenn Gray calls the tyranny of the present in a foxhole. The past, and more important, the future, do not exist. He explains that there is more time for thinking and more loneliness in foxholes at the front than in secure homes, and time is measured in other ways than by clocks and calendars. To the soldier under fire who has reached his limit, even the most horrible army jail looks appealing. What matters is living through the next minute. Gray speculates that this is why soldiers will go on such extraordinary lengths to get souvenirs. At Braecourt Manor, Malarkey ran out into a field being raked by machine gun fire to get what he thought was a Luger from a dead German. In Holland on October 5th, as Webster was limping back to the rear in an open field under fire from a German 88, he spotted a German camouflage poncho, an ideal souvenir. He stopped to scoop it up. Gray explains the phenomenon. Primarily, souvenirs appeared to give the soldier some assurance of his future beyond the destructive environment of the present. They represented a promise that he might survive. It is almost impossible to think of anything but survival in a life-threatening situation, which accounts for the opposite phenomenon to souvenir grabbing. The soldier's casual attitude toward his own possessions, his indifferent attitude toward money. In campaigns of extreme hazard, Gray writes, soldiers learn more often than civilians ever do that everything external is replaceable, while life is not. What is not replaceable is the esteem of comrades. But to the replacement soldier just arrived, there is no comradeship, so there is nothing to hold him to his post. Gray tells the story of a deserter he found in a woods in France in November 1944. The lad was from the Pennsylvania mountains. He was accustomed to camping out. He had been there a couple weeks and intended to stay until the war ended. "All the men I knew and trained with have been killed or transferred," the deserter explained. "I'm lonely. The shells seem to come closer all the time, and I can't stand them." He begged Gray to leave him. Gray refused, said he would have to turn him in, but promised he would not be punished. The soldier said he knew that. He bitterly predicted they would simply put him back into the line again, which was exactly what happened when Gray brought him in. At the front, not only spit and polish discipline breaks down, orders can be ignored, as supervision is not exact where danger of death is present. Old soldiers have learned by bitter experience to be independent and to make their own decisions. Webster wrote his parents shortly after he was wounded, "Once our lieutenant told my squad leader to take his 8 men and knock out some anti-aircraft guns that were firing on a flight of gliders. 9 men with rifles fighting dual-purpose 88s and 40 millimeters. The sergeant said, yes, censored. By using his own judgment, he saved our lives in a situation where a new man would have rushed in blindly. This same lieutenant later ordered 2 scouts into a German position, but they, knowing better, got censored. Veterans tried to help replacements, but they also took care not to learn their names, as they expected them to be gone shortly. It was not that the old hands had no sympathy for the recruits. "Our new members," Webster wrote his parents, "representatives of the 18-year-old draft, were so young and enthusiastic-looking, it seemed a crime to send them into battle. We paratroopers get the best men in the Army, but it's a hell of a fate for somebody who's never been away from home or high school to come here." No man in Easy had been in combat before June 6, 1944. But by October, all the men who took off from England on the evening of June 5th, who were still alive in Holland, had been through 2 combat jumps and 2 campaigns.
This is the end of Disc 6.